There is a timer. What I usually do is I read excerpts from April Raintree so that you get a general idea of what the book is about. And then, as Hartmut said, I open to questions and answers. So that's... That's just what I'm going to start into. Our free idle days with our family came to an abrupt end one summer afternoon. We came home and there were some cars in front of our house. One had flashing red lights on it, and I knew it was a police car. When we entered the house, Mum was sitting at the table, openly weeping, right in front of all the strangers. There were empty medicine bottles on the small counter and the table. I couldn't figure out why the four people were there. A nice-smelling woman knelt down to talk to me. My name is Mrs. Gray. I bet you're April, aren't you? And this little girl must be Cheryl. She put her hand on Cheryl's head in a friendly gesture, but I didn't trust her. I nodded that we were April and Cheryl, but I kept my eyes on my mother. Finally, I asked, "Why is Mum crying? Did you hurt her?" "No, dear. Your mother is ill, and she won't be able to take care of you anymore. Would you like to go for a nice car ride?" the woman asked. My eyes lit up with interest. We'd been in a taxi a few times, and it had been a lot of fun. But then I thought of baby Anna. I looked around for her. "Where is Anna?" "Anna's sick," the woman answered. "She's gone to the hospital." "Don't worry. We'll take you for a ride to a nice clean place, you and Cheryl, okay?" That was not okay. I wanted to stay here. "We can stay with Daddy. He will take care of us." "You can go away now," I said. It was all settled. But Mrs. Gray said in a gentle voice, "I'm afraid not, honey. We have to take you and Cheryl with us. Maybe if your mommy and daddy get well enough, you can come to live with them again." The man who was with Mrs. Gray had gone to our bedroom to get all our things. When he came back, I became more uneasy. I looked from the woman to the man, then over to one policeman who was writing in a notepad, then to the other one who was looking around. I finally looked back at my mom for reassurance. She didn't look at me, but I said in a very definite manner, "No, we'd better stay here." I was hoping Dad would walk in and he would make them all go away. He would make everything right. The man with our belongings leaned over and whispered to my mother. She forced herself to stop sobbing, slowly got up, and came over to us. I could see that she was struggling to maintain control. "April, I want you and Cheryl to go with these people. It will only be for a little while. Right now, Daddy and me, well, we can't take care of you. You'll be all right. You'll be good girls for me. I'm sorry." She couldn't say anymore because she started crying again. She hugged us, and that's when I started crying too. I kind of knew that she was really saying goodbye to us, but I was determined that we were not going to be taken away. I clung to my mom as tight as I could. They wouldn't be able to pull me away from her, and then they would leave. I expected Mom to do the same, but she didn't. She pushed me away into their grasping hands. I couldn't believe it. Frantically, I screamed, "Mommy, please don't make us go. Please, we want to stay with you. Please don't make us go." I tried hard to put everything into my voice, sure that they would all come to their senses and leave us be. There were a lot of grown-up things I didn't understand that day. My mother should have fought with her life to keep us with her. Instead, she had simply handed us over. It didn't make any sense to me. The car door slammed shut on us. "Please don't make us go," I said in a subdued, quiet voice, more to myself. I gripped Cheryl's hand and we set off into the unknown. We were both crying and ignored the soothing voices from the strangers in front. How could Mom do this to us? What was going to happen to us? Well, at least I still had Cheryl. I thought this to myself over and over again. Cheryl kept crying, although I'm not sure she really knew why. She loved car rides, but if I was crying, I'm sure she felt she ought to be crying too. We were taken to an orphanage. When we got there, Cheryl and I were hungry and exhausted. Inside the large building, all the walls were painted a dismal green. The sounds we made echoed down the long, high-ceilinged corridors. Then this person came out of a room to greet us. She was dressed in black from head to foot, except for some stiff white cardboard around her neck and face. She had chains dangling around her waist, and she said her name was Mother Superior, and she had been expecting us. My eyes widened in fear. It was even worse than I had imagined. We were being handed over to the boogeymen for sure. When Mrs. Gray and the man said goodbye and turned to leave, I wanted to go with them, but I was too scared to ask. Mother Superior took us into another room at the far end of the corridor. Here, another woman in the same outfit undressed us and bathed us. She looked through our hair for bugs, she told us. I thought that was pretty silly because I knew that bugs lived in trees and grass, not in people's hair. Of course, I didn't say anything, not even when she started cutting off my long hair. I was thinking that this was like the hen my mother had gotten once. She plucked it clean and later we ate it. I sat there wondering if that was now to be our fate, wondering how I could put a stop to this. Then the woman told me she was finished, and I was relieved to find that I still had some hair left. I watched her cut Cheryl's hair and reasoned that if she was taking the trouble to cut straight, then we had nothing to fear. Between yawns, Cheryl complained that she was hungry, so afterward we were taken to a large kitchen and fed some dry, tasteless food. When we finished eating, we were taken to the infirmary and put to bed. This excerpt is when April is older, about 10 years old, and Cheryl and April, once having been taken from their parents, go back on family visits at the Children's Aid office in a small room. And this is after one of the visits. Mrs. DeRosier had been told that my parents had not come for the visit. That evening at supper time, she told her own children they were fortunate in having a parent like her, as my parents were too busy boozing it up to even come to visit me. I sat silently, not believing a word of what she said, and pretended the insults to my parents didn't even bother me. She was forever putting my parents down, so I was getting used to her remarks. But inside, I despised her more than I would despise my own parents, even if all the things she said about them were true, and I just knew they were not. Later that night, I lay in bed, unable to go to sleep and unable to say my prayers. I couldn't forget that look on Cheryl's face when I had to leave her. I felt anger towards my mother and father because they were responsible. While I was at it, I turned my anger on our Holy Father in heaven. Oh God, why did you let me be born? Why? Why was I ever born? Why do you let these bad things happen to Cheryl and me? You're supposed to be loving, protective, and just, but you're not, God. You're none of those things, if you can let all the bad things happen. You're just a phony, and I hate you. Do you hear me? I hate you. That's how angry I was. I started crying, and by the time I finished, I was overcome with remorse for having thought those things. At last, I was able to say my prayers and ask God to help me be strong and good. For the rest of that month, the DeRosier kids taunted me about having drunk with my parents. It was new ammunition for them to use against me, and it bothered me a lot. One Saturday morning, they started in on me again, and finally I made my feeble defense. They're not drunkards, they're sick, that's all, sick. Sick? Boy, what a dummy you are. But then, half-breeds are pretty stupid, aren't they? Maggie said maliciously. Yeah, your parents didn't know how to take care of you. They just know how to boost it up, Rick added. And then they started mimicking drunken people and talking to each other with slurred speech, laughing at intervals. No, I screamed. I ran out of the house across the grain fields, running as hard and as fast as I could. They had acted and sounded just like my parents and their friends. I remembered. I could run all I wanted, but I couldn't run away from the truth. When I reached the edge of the woods, my sides were aching. I stopped and sat down, my back against a pine tree. I was panting and sobbing very hard. As I caught my breath, I could picture my parents. So, that's why you never got any better. Liars, that's what you are. All those promises of getting well, all those lies about taking medicine. You told us, soon, April, soon, Cheryl, we'll take you back home as soon as we get better. Why, you lied to us. You never intended to get better. You never cared about us. You made Cheryl cry, and you don't even care. And because of you, I'm stuck here. I hate you both for lying to us, and I hope I never see you again. I got up and started walking back to the house because I still had the floors to wash. I stopped and thought, no, why should I? They can beat me if they want to. I don't care. I just don't care anymore. To hell with them. To hell with my parents. To hell with everyone except Cheryl. Even the Dions didn't answer my letters. They lied too. They didn't really care for me. But that's okay, because I don't care for any of them either. I turned back into the woods and made my way through the heavy underbrush. I don't know how far I walked before I came upon a small clearing which bordered the Red River. The sunlight filtered through the towering trees, warming even the shady spots. The area was alive with the sounds of birds, squirrels, and bugs, but I felt at peace. The tensions from the past months were lifted. I knew I felt this way because I was all cried out, and I had decided that for now, I didn't care about anything. I wasn't really thinking about anything when I noticed my arms and hands. They were tanned a deep golden brown. A lot of pure white people tanned just like this. Poor Cheryl. She would never be able to disguise her brown skin as just a tan. People would always know that she was part Indian. It seemed to me that what I'd read and what I'd heard indicated that Métis and Indians were inclined to be alcoholics. I guess that was because they were a weak people. Oh, they were put down more than anyone else. But then, didn't they deserve it? Anyways, I could pass for a pure white person. I could say I was part French and part Irish, if I had to. I could even change the spelling of my name. Raintree, with two E's, looked like one of those Indian names. But if I changed the spelling to Raintree with a Y, that could pass for Irish. And when I grew up, I wouldn't be poor. I'd be rich. Being a half-breed meant being poor and dirty. It meant being weak and having to drink. It meant being ugly and stupid. It meant living off of white people and giving your children to white people to look after. It meant that kids like me had to take what kids like the DeRosiers gave, and none of that was good. Well, I wasn't going to live like a half-breed. When I got free of this place, when I got free from being a foster child, then I would live just like a real white person. Then a question came to mind. What about Cheryl? How was I going to pass for a white person when I had a Métis sister, especially when she was so proud of what she was? I loved her. I could never cut myself off from her completely. And she wouldn't go along with what I planned. I would never even be able to tell her what I planned. I sat there thinking that the problem wouldn't be resolved. Well, I had a long time to figure that one out. For sure, She would never turn out to be like the rest of the Métis people. She and maybe Mrs. McAdams were special people. Cheryl was already a whole lot smarter than all the rest of the kids in her class, and that counted for a lot. I sighed, stood up, and stretched. Now I felt ready to face whatever the DeRosiers had in store for me. One day, I would be free of them. And this is from Cheryl when she's older. White man, to you my voice is like the unheard call in the wilderness. It is there though you do not hear. But this once, take the time to listen to what I have to say. Your history is highlighted by your wars. Why is it all right for your nations to conquer each other in your attempts at dominion? When you sailed to our lands, you came with your advanced weapons. You claimed you were a progressive, civilized people. And today, white man, you have the ultimate weapons, warfare which could destroy all men, all creation. And you allow such power to be in the hands of those few who have such little value and true wisdom. White man, when you first came, most of our tribes began with peace and trust in dealing with you. We showed you how to survive in our homelands. We were willing to share with you our vast wealth. Instead of repaying us with gratitude, you turned on us. You turned on us with your advanced weapons and your cunning trickery. When we, the Indian people, realized your intentions, we rose to do battle to defend our nations, our homes, our food, our lives. And for our efforts, we are labeled savages, and our battles are called massacres. And when our primitive weapons could not match those which you had years and experience to perfect, we realized that peace could not be won unless our mass destruction took place. And so we looked to treaties, and this time we ran into your cunning trickery. And so we lost our lands, our freedom, and we were confined to reservations. And we are held in contempt. As long as the sun shall rise, for you, white man, those are words without meaning. White man, there is much in the deep, simple wisdom of our forefathers. We were here for centuries. We kept the land, the waters, the air clean and pure for our children and for our children's children. Now that you are here, the rivers bleed with contamination. The winds moan with the heavy weight of pollution in the air. The land vomits up the poisons which have been fed into it. Our Mother Earth is no longer clean and healthy. She is dying. White man, in your greedy rush for money and power, you are destroying. Why must you have power over everything? Why can't you live in peace and harmony? Why can't you share the beauty and the wealth which Mother Earth has given us? You do not stop at confining us to small pieces of rock and muskeg. Where are the animals of the wilderness to go when there is no more wilderness? Why are the birds of the skies falling to their extinction? Is there joy for you when you bring down the mighty trees of our forests? No living thing seems sacred to you. In the name of progress, everything is cut down, and progress means only profits. White man, you say that we are a people without dignity, but when we are sick, weak, hungry, poor, when there is nothing for us but death, what are we to do? We cannot accept a life which you have imposed on us. You say that we are drunkards, that we live for drinking, but drinking is a way of dying. Dying without enjoying life. You have given us many diseases. It is true that you have found immunizations for many of these diseases, but this was done more for your own benefit. The worst disease for which there is no immunity is the disease of alcoholism, and you condemn us for being its easy victims, and those who do not condemn us weep for us and pity us. So we, the Indian people, we are still dying. The land we lost is dying too. White men, you have our land now. Respect it as we once did. Take care of it as we once did. Love it as we once did. White man, our wisdom is dying as we are. But take heed. If Indian wisdom dies, you white man will not be far behind. So weep not for us. Weep for yourselves and for your children and for their children, because you are taking everything today, and tomorrow there will be nothing left for them. I see more and more of what April sees, broken people with broken houses and broken furniture. The ones I see on Main Street, the ones who give us our public image, the ones I see puking all over public sidewalks, battling it out with each other, their blood smearing up city-owned property, women selling what's left of themselves for a cheap bottle of wine. No wonder April ran. She was horrified that this was her legacy. She disowned it, and now she's trapped in that life of glitter and tinsel, still going nowhere. Charitable organizations, what a load of crap. Surrounded by a lot of people, business-wise but empty, just like the Main Street bums. The more I see of these streets, the more I wonder if April isn't right. Just maybe. Better to live that empty life than live out on the streets. What if I do find our parents? Sometimes I can't help it. I feel like April does. I despise these people, these gutter creatures. They are losers. But there is a reason why they are like that. Everything they once had has been taken from them, and the white bureaucracy has helped create the image of parasitic natives. But sometimes I do wonder if these people don't accept defeat too easily, like a dog with his tail between his legs, on his back, his throat forever exposed. April 1970. Happy birthday, April. What do you give the person who has everything? I can give peace of mind with a few lies. May 1970. Struck pay dirt with a new address on Austin. The place is rented by a woman named Josie Pohaquitas. I knock on the door, and it is opened by this little bent old woman who is stoned out of her mind, but happy as hell. I have figured out by now it's better to see these people at certain times of the day. You have to be late enough so they can start getting over last night's drunk, and early enough so they're not whacked out of it yet. I ask if she knows Henry or Alice Raintree. Henry Raintree, she says in a French-type accent. Yes, I'm his daughter, and I've been looking for him. Ah, yes, mais oui, we're good friends, you know. Come in. Here, sit down. He comes to our place when the snows are gone. He goes north for winters. He is welcome here. He stays. Sometimes we have big party. Sometimes we have big fight. Then he goes. But he always comes back, Henry does. He will come back. You come back in a couple of weeks. You will see. He will be here then. June 1970. I knock at this door again, having been here a few times with no luck and expecting none this time. Ah, Cheryl, it's you again. Come in, come in. Her face lights up into a big grin. Henry, come out here and see the surprise that is here for you. Hurry up, Henry. Her voice is high-pitched and squeaky. She never pronounces the H's. An old gray-haired man comes walking out of the kitchen. He is trying to keep his balance. Curiosity is piercing through his drunken haze. I assume that Josie has told him about me, but still it's a few minutes before he realizes it's me. My smile disappears, but a smile slowly appears on that leathery, unshaven face. No, no, it can't be. Not my little daughter, Cheryl. My little baby. You're all grown up now. He chuckles and staggers a little closer to me. He makes a visible effort to draw himself up, but he has drunk too much already, and the feat is beyond him. His clothes are worn and dirty. tears of happiness and perhaps awakened guilt pour from his watery eyes. The woman Josie is beaming with pride as if this joyful reunion were all her doing. It's like a miracle, it's like a miracle, she cackles over and over again, watching father and daughter facing each other. I am rooted to the very spot, absorbing the true picture of my father. I make no effort to move towards him. This goes unnoticed, and the old man approaches me. I cannot believe that we are standing here, face to face, at long last. At long, long last, the decrepit old man says. I stand quietly, hiding the horror which is boiling inside of me. I hadn't known what to expect, but it wasn't this bent, wasted human form in front of me, my father. I am horrified and repulsed by him, by the cackling, prune-faced woman, by the others who have crawled out of the kitchen to watch all this happiness, all of them with stupid grins on their faces, by the surrounding decay, by the hopelessness. The cancer from the houses I've been to have spread into this house too, to destroy. All my dreams to rebuild the spirit of a once proud nation are destroyed in this instant. I study the pitiful creature in front of me, my father, a gutter creature. The imagination of my childhood has played a horrible, rotten trick on me. All these years, until this very moment, I envisioned him as a tall, straight, handsome man. In the olden days, he would have been a warrior if he had been all Indian. I had made something out of him that he wasn't, never was. Now I just want to turn and run away, pretend this isn't happening, that I had never laid eyes on him, pretend I was an orphan. I should have listened to April. Awkwardly, he hugs me. I smell the foul stink of liquor on him. Hell, he probably sweats the liquor out of his pores. I close my eyes so no one will see what's in them. I hold my breath against the gutter smell. Seems like ages before he releases me. When he does, he turns to the others and says, "Don't just stand there. Bring her a drink. Now we have something to celebrate. I found my little girl after all these years. Tell me, Cheryl, where is your sister? Where is April? I missed you both so much. Ah, here we are." He hands me a beer and wipes his tears and runny nose on the sleeve of his shirt. I don't answer. I just think to myself, April is far away from you, and she'll never know what you are. Gratefully, I swallow some beer. Disgust, hatred, shame. Yes, for the first time in my life, I feel shame. How do I describe the feeling? I swallow more beer. I stay for the rest of the day in spite of my desire to flee. I stay because I want to know about Mum. But I want Dad sober when I ask him about her. Funny, I can still refer to him as Dad. I drink away the hours and pass the dizzy, nauseous sensations, laughing stupidly with them. Josie puts me to bed on a battered couch in the living room. Next morning, I wait patiently for Dad to get up. It is almost noon. He comes into the kitchen. He looked in rough shape last night, but now he looks worse, with his weak, flabby arms showing because he's in a torn, grayish undershirt. His dark-colored baggy pants are held up by suspenders that are frayed to the breaking point and all twisted. I get coffee for Dad. Josie is busy puttering around the kitchen. No one talks. The only noises come from Dad slurping his coffee. Finally, I ask him, "Dad, could we talk?" Sounds like I'm shouting. I lower my voice. "I want to know about Mum. How is she? Do you see her?" Dad makes a gesture as if he doesn't want to talk about her right now, but I persist. "Please, Dad, tell me about Mum. Where is she?" Tears come to his eyes again. He says simply, "She died last July." "Died? Mum died?" I ask, not believing. I then figure out that Mum was in poor health when we were kids, and that's why she died. I wish I could have seen her. Maybe that's why Dad turned to booze. He misses her so much, he can't live without her. I can forgive that, retract all the bad thoughts about him. But Dad speaks again. I may as well tell you everything. He sighs and lapses into another long silence. I try to make it shorter by urging him to continue. Tell me what, Dad? Your mother took her own life. She killed herself, he says at last. She left a letter for me, but I had gone up north early that year. I have a nephew in Dauphin. I stop in there sometimes. They sent the letter there. She jumped off the Louise Bridge last July. I took the letter to the RCMP, and they checked with the Winnipeg police. They had found a body, and everything matched your mama. She was not happy with her life. Once she lost you girls and Anna died, she knew she would never get you girls back again. Those visits were too hard on her, so she stopped going. She tried to kill herself before, once a long time ago. I digest what he says. Too hard on her? What about April and me in those foster homes? Okay, only one was real bad, and April suffered most of that one. But I suffered for April. And the other ones, those people weren't our flesh and blood. They weren't even our race. I remember now those promises you made us, promises we believed, all the waiting for you to take us back home, all the loyalty we gave you, all for nothing. Who's Anna? I'm angry, but I don't want to fight. I want information. Dad looks at me surprised. You don't know about Anna? Oh, of course not. You were just a baby yourself when she died. April must remember her. Maybe not. She was just little, too. And Anna wasn't with us very long. She was your baby sister, but she was a sick baby. They should have kept her in the hospital longer, but no, they sent her home too early and she died. They blamed your mama and me. That was their excuse for taking you girls away from us. No, my girl, your mama was not a happy woman. Why didn't you come to see us when we were kids? I ask in a soft voice, afraid of an honest answer. There is another long pause. I went up north for a long time. I was never here to visit you again, he says, as if that's a good enough reason. No, your mama did not want you girls to see the way she was. She was too ashamed. She couldn't face you again. They shouldn't have taken you away from us. The baby was just sick, that's all. Dad drifts off into silence again. Well, I'll start off by telling you about writing the book. I think it's probably already in the write-up. I'm not really sure what new information I can say, because a lot of it is in the write-up that you did. But I guess telling you myself, the reason why I wrote my book is because of a second suicide in my family, and In Search of April Raintree is autobiographical in the way that April's life story was similar to mine, in the way that her parents were alcoholics, and that her and her sister grew up in foster homes, and then there were suicides in April's family, and also April was raped, but most importantly, the way that April came back to her native roots. Not because of a hero, but because her sister died. And that's what connected me with, I guess, April is that realization that that's what happened in my life. Because when I started out to write this book, I didn't think that was going to be a major factor in the book, that April was going to have this search for identity. But during the rewrites of doing this book, it came out like that. And so the end is very much the way things happened with me. Yes.
Did you say that the act of writing your thoughts helped you come to terms with your experience?
Yeah, like writing helped an awful lot, because just out of my writing, it came to me that, like, I'm ashamed of being a Métis person, you know, I'm ashamed of being part Indian. And I knew that when I was young, growing up, like from the age of 10 to when I went on my own as an adult, I realized that I was ashamed, although I didn't admit that I was ashamed, I just didn't, you know. And then when I was an adult, I think, well, one of the first things I did was I ran away to Toronto, and that's when I was 16, 17, I ran away to Toronto, and there in Toronto, like, there's hardly, well, I didn't see any other Native people or anything, so I was really able to lose myself in the crowd, kind of thing, and not think about Native people. And the other part of it was that because I was taken away when I was 3, like, I had no connection with other Native people except for my own family, whom I saw on family visits mostly, and everyone that surrounded me, like, were white people, you know, like, I was in a white foster families with white social workers and white teachers, and all the authority figures around us, like, were white people. So it's only natural that you know, figure you're like nothing. So when I grew up, when I got older, I just lived without paying attention to anything Native. And it was only after I started writing In Search of April Raintree, then of course I had to do research, because when I wrote this book, I still had really no Native connections. And then I wrote the first draft, and then of course I had to do research, so then I started looking for information on Native people and organizations in Winnipeg. And I started writing the book to look for answers on why all these things, you know, why were my parents alcoholics, why did I have to grow up in foster homes. And by the way, my other foster sisters, I had 3 main foster sisters, and they were all Native too. So that reinforced the idea that, you know, like, if you're a Native, you can't take care of yourself. And out of that comes, you know, like, there's a Native girl syndrome speech that's given by Mrs. Sample, one of the social workers. And you get that idea too, that not too much is expected from you, that, the you know, probably the worst is expected from you. And so when you do grow up with that, you have a lot of problems, I think, adjusting to a society that doesn't want you around anyways, you know. So um, Yeah, so anyways, once In Search of April Raintree was published, then I was asked to be more involved, you know, like I got involved with the Winnipeg Coalition on Native Child Welfare. And this was organized by a coalition of Native people and organizations in Winnipeg to do something about the Children's Aid Society, which I grew up in, under which I grew up. And they wanted to form their own center that would be run by Native people, for Native people, and begin having a control over our own lives kind of thing. And so with In Search of April Raintree, that's partly how I did start getting, that's one of the first things I got involved with in the Native community. Yes.
Could you say something about your projects right now? Are you writing something new? What are you working on?
I haven't written another novel, although I kind of have one in my head. And this year, I'm hoping to get it down, do the first rough draft of this novel that I have in my head. I have to get it now into the computer. And but I do keep getting sidetracked, like there's a lot of other things I'd rather do too, so it's hard to write on my own, because it's not that I have a contract for another novel or anything. It's, you know, there's a good possibility of being published again, I guess, but unless I have a contract, I'm not really motivated to write on my own. The things I've done in the past, like is in 91 I started working on a play, and Thompson Highway is the one who got me to do that. He phoned me up one day, and he asked if I would, like, why didn't I write a play? And I said, okay, you know, I'd do that. of course, this was without, like, I don't go to theater because I have a hard time hearing. And I get frustrated if I can't hear the actors and that, or I miss the idea of the play, you know. The first time I did go to a play, there was intermission, and I thought the play was over, so we were going to leave. But then we found out like nobody else is leaving, so we stayed for Act Two, you know. But that's how green I was about theater. And but I wrote this play for Native Earth, and it did, you know, fairly well. It was like, I liked it, kind of. You know, there's always some weak spots that you want to improve. So I'm not really finished writing that play. It's I want to do a few other things with it. And before that, I had written a short film script for the National Film Board. It was one of a series of four, and it was a 15-minute piece that, with the other four, would be an hour long. And it was produced for children for use in education. It was about racism, and it was aimed at young kids from 7 years old to about 11 years old. And of course, that was my first film script. And again, you know, somebody asked me if I would consider writing a film script, and I said, sure. So that's pretty much how I get involved in things. Somebody asks me if I want to do something, and I say yes, and then I have to do it. So this year, though, I do want to finish this novel. It's another novel. It's not with In Search of April Rain Tree. It was this book is very personal, as I said, because it's based on a lot of things that happened in my life, and it was motivated by a suicide. And if that suicide had never happened, I never would have written a book at all, because I wasn't planning on being a writer, and I wasn't practiced at being a writer. But suddenly I had this thing to do, and so I did it.